supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. When I was growing up, nobody knew about learning disabilities. It was the 50s and early 60s. Kids who struggled in school were quickly labeled either lazy or not very bright. I know, because those were the labels I carried through most, if not all, of my education. It wasn't until much, much later that I realized I had a learning disability. As a matter of fact, it wasn't until I was doing Voices in the Family some 20 years ago. Nowadays, psychologists and educators recognize a wide variety of learning disabilities, but that doesn't mean children living with them have it easy. Our discussion today will bring to light some of the challenges these disabilities cause and consider some ways these challenges can be overcome. My guests are Philip Schultz and Richard Selznick. Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and author of My Dyslexia, a memoir about his inner life with dyslexia. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Dan.
Richard Selznick is a psychologist, professor of pediatrics in New Jersey. He's the author of The Shutdown Learner, Helping Your Academically Discouraged Child. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. And our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If you have a learning disability or a child who has one, give us a call. Richard, let's start with you. The whole idea of learning disability is a pretty big umbrella. There's lots of kinds of learning disabilities, and within each one, there's different degrees of severity. So what is it?
Well, you know, it's considered to be a problem in the wiring, neurologically based, and it results in breakdowns of communication, you know, taking in information, understanding it, doing something with it once it gets inside, and if it comes in a bit scrambled, you might have trouble knowing how to react. Also, significant number of learning disabilities involve reading, spelling, and writing, which is the heart of what gets more often than not referred to in schools for evaluations, things like that.
So, excuse me, speaking of evaluations, how do we find out whether our child has one? I'm wondering about the testing per se, because
right.
We could go to two different psychologists and get two vastly different.
It's even more complicated than that.
Oh, great.
I wish we were in a simple field, Dan. We're not. And some of it is complicated by the school's model of what a learning disability is versus a, let's say, a private professional's model of what a learning disability is. So there could be a lot of variation in terms of definition. I believe that a child should start with a good psychoeducational evaluation, whether it is done by the schools or in the private sector. And that psychoeducational evaluation should yield a fair amount of information as to what your child's profile of strengths and weaknesses are, and where are those points of breakdown, and what you can do to overcome them.
That's a big word, psychoeducational evaluation.
Right.
It's more than a pencil and paper test.
Much more than a pencil and paper test. I have not been able to get out from under my own, you know, I wish I could just give a child a paper and pencil test. It's a long process. And a psychoeducational evaluation, I try to stay away from jargon as much as possible, but basically involves my interacting with a child over a number of different tasks from, say, the cognitive domain, which is talking about a child's you know, thought processes, as well as from academic functioning areas, and getting input from the child's parents in terms of, you know, what they observe on a day-to-day basis. So it's a lot of data that is put together in a clinical evaluation that is far from just a paper and pencil test.
I've got to tell you, Rich, the reason I asked you that is so that anybody who's listening to the show now who might want to have their child evaluated, it's important to know that if it's not comprehensive, it's not fair.
I totally agree with that. And, you know, Dan, you and I have had conversations in the past about how complicated all this can be. Part of the problem, too, with a comprehensive evaluation in the private sector is that it also is expensive, and it could cost a lot of money. But I do agree with you fully that getting a simple 15-minute, 20-minute look over and putting a child on medication is problematic from my point of view.
Right, for most of us. Phil, you have what's called dyslexia. So tell us what that is and what it was like as a child.
Well, you know, when I was a child, I didn't know what I had.
Right.
I just thought I was dumb. I was placed in the this table called the dummy class for three of us. I wasn't really, I didn't know I had it until my son in the second grade, when he was in the second grade, was diagnosed with it, and I was 58. So I could tell you what it was like back then, but I was completely oblivious of anything. Looking back, I now, you know, have some idea of what was like.
Did you think you were a dummy, really?
Yeah, I still do.
You still do?
I mean, once in a dummy class, always in a dummy class.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're labeled like that, I mean, I know now. I mean, this memoir came about because I was suddenly, after I got the Pulitzer, I was being interviewed, and in each and every interview, I was talking about being dyslexic, which I had no idea why. Why now was I talking about something that I hadn't really thought much about? It was my son's issue, not mine. And it was because it was coming to the surface, and it was hard for me with this label of dummies don't win Pulitzers, and how in the world had I done that?
Well, wait a minute. So, what's your answer? Dummies don't win. Is this the exception when a dummy actually did win?
I mean, no. I mean, the truth of the matter is that dyslexics are often very bright, that there's a gifted component, and that there's a real advantage in being dyslexic. Creativity, you can't do this, so you learn to do this. It's compensatory thinking. It's thinking a couple of steps ahead. There's a good, very good aspect of being dyslexic, which we see in our child, and I see in many children, talking to parents of dyslexic children. I didn't know that, though. So I only found this out when I was in my late 50s. And so my experience with being dyslexic was being stupid.
You're listening to Philip Schultz. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet who's written about his own dyslexia. And we're also joined by Richard Selznick, a psychologist and expert on learning disabilities, and that's what we're talking about today on Voices. If you want to join the conversation, we're at 888-477-9499. Phila, I'd like to get back to you, back to your childhood. Things were obviously pretty ugly for you in school. You were held back in the third grade, and you were asked to leave school. What was life like for you? You were just such a little boy.
I was actually held back twice. I would be bullied, made fun of for learn anything. Math, I would listen to instruction. I would be embarrassed and get up and leave the room. Kids made fun of me. I did what I saw the tough guys in the movies. Hit kids.
Yeah.
Because of the combination of behavioral problems and learning problems, I was just asked to leave, kicked out of school.
And
third grade, and I went to the new school, which was the toughest school in Rochester, taking the third grade over, and the teacher dealt with me by not dealing with me. We were just sequestered away at the corner table, looking at her back as she addressed all the other students.
Richard, these issues that Phil struggles with, this is pretty typical of young kids with learning disabilities. What's life like for them?
You know, we've certainly have come a long way from the 1950s and putting kids in dummy classes. But I don't think a day goes by in my professional world where I don't see children who are struggling with what I think of in terms of being in the deeper part of the pool where they are unable to handle it. So, you know, when I talked about shutdown learner style kids, these are kids who over time, it's like the air is leaking out of the tire for them. You know, there's a real depletion over time in terms of their emotional fuel, their ability to meet the demands of the task, their sense of frustration, and a lot of what I think needs to happen with these kids is turning them around emotionally, you know, so that sense of frustration hasn't changed all that much.
What's going on in their brains?
I think that with the kids that I see, you have to almost go task by task in terms of what the demands are that are being asked of them, but my core sense is that they're feeling a sense of confusion. You know, that there's a confusion in terms of the information coming in, you know, what do I do with it, how do I respond, you know.
And then, of course, then, am I a dummy?
I mean, underneath this is a huge issue of self-esteem, for certainly.
Yeah, I remember feeling there's something wrong here. I don't think I'm stupid.
Right.
I don't think I'm lazy because I'm working my butt off here.
I tend to think of it as God's cruel joke. It's kind of like, you know, some of us get good things. You know, we get a little of this that we're pretty good at. You know, we're decent with our social skills or our verbal abilities. But our math brain really isn't very good, let's say. Or I might have excellent spatial thinking, which is what a shutdown learner style child tends to have. They're great with spatial and visual, but their ability to read a selection within their grade level is very weak and
right.
deficient. So
it's a
tremendous variability, I think, for a lot of us, really.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to continue the conversation with Phil. I want to hear some of his magnificent poetry just about this, around the self-esteem issue. So we'll be back in 60 short seconds. We're talking about learning disabilities. Our guests are Dr. Richard Selznick. He's a psychologist, author of The Shutdown Learner. Phil Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet who's written about his own dyslexia. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
ChristianaCare Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
Do you have love, time, or resources to help one child? Bethany Christian Services, a national nonprofit adoption agency, envisions a world where every child has a loving family. Since 1944, Bethany has provided adoption and foster care services, licensed in more than 30 states, including Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. To learn ways to care for vulnerable children in our region and around the world, 800-215-0702 or bethany.org. Bethany Christian Services supports WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about learning disabilities with Philip Schultz. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. He's the founder and director of the Writer's Studio in New York, where he teaches writing. Richard Selznick is a psychologist, professor of pediatrics, and he directs the Cooper Learning Center in Voorhees, New Jersey. Rich, are these genetic based, if you're talking about wiring?
Yeah, it's funny how when families come in and the parents start telling the story of their child, or when I start to give the results, usually one or the other parent, more often than not the dad, is sitting there going, I was just like that. That's my life.
Right.
And, you know, the story that Phil tells is repeated many times over. In fact, Charles Schwab, to my knowledge, had that same experience when he brought his own child in for an evaluation of a learning disability, and that light bulb went off. Oh, my God, I had this. So, yeah, there's a tremendous family predisposition for these issues.
Yeah, I just had that conversation with my daughter, who's, right, you know, 38 years old.
Sure.
But, Phil, so speaking of genetics, your Pulitzer Prize-winning collection of poetry is called Failure. And one of the best-known poems in there is about your father as a failure. Do you mind reading it for us?
I would. Go ahead.
Are you there?
Yes, yes. Here. I was just opening the book. Failure. To pay for my father's funeral, I borrowed money from people he already owed money to. One called him a nobody. No, I said, he was a failure. Can't remember a nobody. That's why they're called nobodies. Failures are unforgettable. The rabbi who read a stock eulogy about a man who didn't belong to or believe in anything, both a failure and a nobody, failed to imagine the son and wife of the dead man being shamed. To understand that not believing in, belonging to any, demanded a kind of an uncle, counting on his fingers my father's business failures, parking lot that raised, motel that raffled honeymoons, bowling alley with roving mariachi, failed to love and honor his brother, who showed him how to whistle under covers, steal apples with sprite. My father was comical. His watch is pinched, gripped on his pant cuffs, and snored loudly in movies where weariness. He didn't believe in savings, insurance, newspapers, vegetables, good or evil, human frailty, history. Our family avoided us, fearing. I left town.
Phil?
Yes?
We keep losing you.
I'm sorry.
Your voice keeps cutting away. Are you moving your mouth away from the phone? Because the poem is just beautiful. And we're missing it.
I don't think so. I'm on a cordless phone. It's a landline, but it's a cordless. And sorry to hear that. I you want me to read it again, or
no? That's okay. But you know, the poem essentially. I hate to say this to a poet, but you know, it's about your father's failures and in a way the scars you carry.
Yes.
From his failures, did you experience yourself as a failure as a child?
Well, that's a very good point, a very good question. It's only recently that I understand that my going through what I did, dyslexic, dummy class, low self-esteem, allowed me to have the kind of understanding and compassion toward his ordeal that I probably would not have had otherwise.
Right.
Having and being burdened with two stories to tell probably had something to
do. Yeah.
Impetus to write.
Yeah. You know what? I'm going to chat with Richard for a minute around this whole theme of the scars we carry, and maybe you could pick up a corded line because your voice is still going.
Okay. I don't know if we have one in the house, but I'll do what I can.
Okay. All right. So we do carry scars. We do. What can be done to mitigate? I would imagine the family plays a major role in whether or not we have deep scars.
Yeah, well, I created this formula for the shutdown learner. We talked about cracks in the foundation plus time plus a lack of understanding. You know, as these cracks show up early on, say 5, 6, 7 years old, and there's often a lack of understanding as to what these issues are, the family systems, the straining, the communication problems, often the yelling at the child starts to ensue. You know, people have their buttons pushed very strongly by school-based issues. When the child's not handing in his homework or doing it poorly, from their point of view, they think the child's not trying hard enough. All of those issues start to kind of come to the surface. So I think one of the things that can be really done is to have the family understand more about what the child is going through so that they can learn to tone it down a little bit. You know, take the heat out of the interaction. You know, 90%, maybe more, of the kids that I work with or have met over the years, and I probably have met thousands, want to do well. It's a rare child who is self-sabotaging and looking to just, you know, in a sense, stick it to the system, you know? So there's something typically going on with the child that is resulting in the difficulty there.
Yeah, I want to go to the phones, and I want to go to Laura on line 5, because she comes in on this theme. Laura, hi, you're on the air. Do we have you? We are having our phone difficulty. Oh, Lisa, I'm sorry. Lisa?
Yes.
Sorry about the name thing.
That's okay. Yeah, I am calling because from a point of view of a parent of a child who is diagnosed with a learning disability, the frustration of coming from us, and how do other parents deal with this? When your child is doing fine in school, in fourth grade, it's all starting to go downhill. You live in one of the best school system areas. Teachers are not saying anything other than not trying hard enough. You go to a private, we went to a private psychologist, spent a lot of money. In seventh grade, they found nothing. By 10th grade, I didn't know if my child was going to graduate high school, and we shelled out a lot of money and found another private psychologist who was kind of dumbfounded when she saw that the first psychologist found nothing, because my daughter did have a learning disability, and thank God it was found out, and she was helped, you know, when she graduated high school and graduated college. But maybe there are other parents out there that get that first evaluation, and, you know, thank God we got a second one in 10th grade, but what do parents do when they get that first evaluation and it's found to be nothing? So they don't think that there's anything really wrong with the child that can be helped other than just, I guess, yelling and screaming at them, which never works.
I got a question before I turn it over to the real expert here.
Okay.
Back in, what did you say, fourth grade?
Up until fourth grade, she was flying high. Then it starts to get difficult,
right.
I guess,
Tell me about your instinct in fourth grade. What did your gut tell you?
Well, I live with a lot of guilt because maybe my gut was incorrect. My gut just told me back then that she was just not trying hard enough. We didn't see any other signs, and we thought, you know, maybe it was a little bit of laziness, or, you know, a little lack of maturity too compared to the other children in her grade as well. So there was social. It all came to social as well as academic.
Okay, so let's now turn to the real expert.
Well, hopefully you didn't consult with me, Lisa, back then. But so, you know, it's funny that Dan asked that question because about what were you going through? Because when people ask me what to do about the shutdown learner style child or the dyslexic, the number one thing to do as a mom, typically the moms are usually the ones leading, you know, the kids into the office, is to trust your gut. You know, I would guess that another part of your gut was telling you that there was something off. It might not have been as strong enough to register on, say, the school's, you know, classification system. You can be in the average range and still have difficulty with reading and spelling and writing. So my guess would be that your gut was saying, you know, there's something wrong here. Now, if you can, when people are telling you, I mean, you don't want to be shopping doctors. On the other hand, you know, if someone says, oh, she's fine, and you know she's not, then I think that needs to be pursued.
It's the same thing as when you take a child on the autism spectrum to a pediatrician,
right.
And they say they'll outgrow it. And your gut says...
Your gut saying it's not.
No.
That's right.
And
right.
Yeah.
You know that there's something
and
going
you've
on.
Got to trust your gut more than you
that's
trust
That's the number one thing to do.
Expert.
Listen to yourself as a mom.
How many kids are lazy?
You know, human nature has a bit of laziness. We all kind of like to sort of kick back and not face our responsibilities. So I think there's a component of laziness. I just don't, you know, or just not meeting, you procrastinate. On the other hand, I think that for the most part, kids are not lazy. By and large, they want to succeed and would like to have you as a parent or the teacher recognize, you know, you're okay. That this is something that you're trying hard enough. And so, you know, sometimes it's not just trying harder. You
right,
know?
Right. And for Lisa and others in her position, if your child is bright and they're not performing well, there's a problem. And it's unlikely that it's just laziness. Is that right, Rich?
That's what I see all the time. I rarely see kids that are not, it's sort of like what, bright for what? You know, I've got the kids coming in who are very bright for Lego building, you know, bright for spatial thinking. They might not be as, say, bright or not as sharp for certain language processes, but certainly they're bright, you know, and the reverse of that is true as well.
Lisa, thanks so much for your call. I hope it was helpful. Phil, we got you back?
I would love to respond to that, too.
Oh, please, yeah.
I feel that in my experience, in my own life, experiences.
You're fading again.
Oh, okay. Well, my experience in teaching kids, that I've never met a lazy kid.
Right.
That laziness isn't part of it. That part of dyslexia and having your brain wired weirdly is an enormous amount of anxiety when you're asking it to do something it doesn't seem to want to do or do naturally.
Right.
That anxiety makes kids back off from instruction and school and whatever and may appear lazy, but that laziness...
How did your parents react to your... Well, you didn't have a label, but how did your parents react to your learning disability?
My case, they were immigrants. I mean, my father was born in Russia, and he wasn't really around much. I suspect he was dyslexic, too. I never saw him read anything.
Hmm.
Dropped out of school in the seventh grade. My mother was heroic. She wanted very much for me to get out of the neighborhood and not have a filing job, a minimum wage job like she had, so she made and overcome with grief and did everything she could to help me. I went to a tutor who wasn't able to teach me.
So your mother, even if she didn't have answers, sounds like she was compassionate and
yes.
Certainly not rejecting.
Worked with me with comic books every night, read to me, hoping that I would... I was 11. Fifth grade when I finally learned. That was very, very late. And she had part of her had all but given up.
It's I'm sure you've been told this before. It's a little weird for a kid with dyslexia to become a poet and an author. Like, tell us about that trajectory.
You're asking me?
Yeah.
Well, it's ironic. It doesn't seem to go together naturally, but my answer to that is that kids are wildly imaginative and have all kinds of capabilities and possibilities, and there, since there was the reality of the life I lived in was so unwelcoming and so difficult, I retreated into my imagination, and which is why a lot of kids with learning disabilities go into the arts, that...
Right.
Place with where I was making the rules, and it was a place where I could process emotion and deal with it at my own time in my own way. So it led to, even though I couldn't write, I had painted at first and became the school cartoonist and dealt with feelings of low self-esteem. seen that way, and it led finally to being a writer.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. We've got Maya on the line. Hi, Maya.
How are you?
Hi.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Oh, I just wanted to comment because the story of your guest resident.
Oh, we're having difficulty.
Yes, I was.
Yeah, we're having difficulty with this phone line, too. Maya, I'm...
Okay. Hello, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm seeing that your guest story does resonate with me because when I was in school, I had some writing difficulties. And then later, when I was in college, I was diagnosed with a learning disability. But throughout my college experience, throughout my law school experience, I was able to learn coping mechanisms, which helped me cope with that. And I did find that some of the aspects of me having a learning disability, such as being more creative and focusing on more of the creative, do help me significantly in my career.
Huh. It really is all about compensatory mechanisms. That's really interesting to me that you went to law school. I mean, that's all about reading and comprehension.
Yes, and it wasn't, by the time I got to law school, I developed a certain level of coping mechanisms that helped me, but with the additional time through the accommodations, it was, I won't say easy, but it made it definitely easier. But what some of the problems for me was running into professors who didn't necessarily understand it, and it was kind of like being put in the dummy class, like your guest
talked
about.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Maya, thanks so much for your call.
All right, you have a good day.
You too. So, Phil, you developed, you know, you were talking about your compensatory mechanisms, but even when you were young, I mean, you had a mind that you wrote in your book that told you that if I can't do this, then I can do that. So it was like your mind was trying to compensate that way back when you were a child.
Well, I was smart. I didn't know I was smart. And I was trying to, I didn't have an alternative. I had to succeed. I had to do something. And my mind found a way of going around obstacles and using my imagination and the intelligence that I had, although I never saw myself as intelligent.
Right.
You know what it's like in a way, that there were all these obstacles, and I run into this all the time. And there was this, at this learning disability function, there was this young 16-year-old girl, Melissa Kay, I think her name, who won a major math award from NASA. It was a national contest, and she won. And she beat all these non-learning disabled kids, and when she got up to accept the award, she said she did because dyslexia was her secret weapon. She knew it was her secret weapon. She understood that the difficulty of getting to the point where you can go over the hurdles of anxiety and whatever to the problem itself, is the problem itself isn't so scary anymore. Mm. That the others were just doing what they did naturally. They were applying themselves to a problem. But by the time learning disabled kids get to the problem, there's almost a sense of relief. It's like, you know, overcoming a 300-pound bully, a 200-pound bully, and suddenly the problem is a 90-pound bully, and it isn't that intimidating anymore.
Hmm. It's really an interesting perspective. Phil, before we go to break, I'm going to ask you a question that I would only ask a poet or a Buddhist.
And which am I here?
I know. So, what's your mind like?
Well, it's a weird place to live. It's strange. It's, I think that there's areas where I don't like myself to this day, that I feel extremely vulnerable. I think just dealing with dyslexia makes you feel very exposed and vulnerable to the world, and so that part I've learned to write out of, and it's given me an edge. It's That's a very interesting and original question. It's a relationship that is still no doubt evolving, and I think that it's getting better all the time. It's a marriage that looks like it's for keeps, but it demands an enormous amount of effort and work.
Mm. And you know what? Like any other intimate relationship, it requires kindness.
Wonderful. Yes, that I have found that developing a sense of sympathy, which is what I teach in the school.
Right.
My school method comes out of my dyslexia. That being sympathetic to that kid in the past, when I couldn't then, makes all the difference. Creating characters. The writers often don't feel sympathy for the very characters that they identify with, because there's something that is less than sympathetic with themselves.
Mm.
And I think that kindness is the best way of putting it.
We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about learning disabilities with Philip Schultz. He's written My Dyslexia, a memoir about his inner life with dyslexia. Richard Selznick, he's the author of The Shutdown Learner, Helping Your Academically Discouraged Child. And of course, we'll take many more of your phone calls when we come back. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Drexel University supports WHYY. If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in a research study called Project Well at Drexel University. This year-long weight loss study is sponsored by the National Institutes of Health and is designed to help adult participants lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings is included. For more information, 215-762-1111, 215-762-1111. Penswood Village, a Quaker-directed active senior living community, supports WHYY. Situated on 82 acres in Bucks County, Penswood Village offers residential, health, and community services designed to meet the needs of people over 65. Amenities include garden apartment living, Type A all-inclusive life care, and a newly renovated community building. A green community, Penswood welcomes applications for future residency. For details or a tour, 888-454-1122 or penswood.org.
Back on Voices in the Family, I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about learning disabilities with Richard Selznick. He directs the Cooper Learning Center in Voorhees, New Jersey. Phil Schultz, he's the founder and director of the Writer's Studio in New York, where he teaches. Rich, we've been talking about this business right before our break of kind of self-acceptance, kindness toward self. This is kind of difficult for shutdown learners or others with learning disability. They're criticized at school. They're often told there's something wrong with them. They have difficulties at home. They're oftentimes bullied. And then they're sent to a learned psychologist, and the message is, you've got something wrong with you. Maybe Selznick can fix it.
Yeah, well, I work hard to try and normalize for the child. It goes back to my early roots, where my dad was a real champion of the underdog. He was an educator and really, you know, reached out to kids that were struggling. And, you know, I like to have kids walk out of my office feeling, wow, that was fun. You know, that wasn't so bad. And I try to stay away from terms like disabled, deficient, and say, look, this part of your brain is kind of working very well, and I use my own experiences, just like, you know, you and Phil were talking about, and put it into more of a perspective for the child to walk out feeling, you know, I am okay. My brain is as good as everybody else's, but I need to work on these reading skills, for example.
What about the big picture, though, Rich, about these kids who spent a lifetime, a youth, as a child being criticized and put down, and no doubt harsh on themselves? It's hard for self-compassion to evolve.
Sure. You know, a lot of it, you know, in Sally Shaywitz, in her book Overcoming Dyslexia, she also talks about the learning disability being encapsulated in a sea of strengths, which I really like that image. And, you know, when the family system, which you can certainly appreciate, is working with the child and not across purposes, and people are trying to understand, a lot can happen. And, you know, the child does not have to become a casualty to all of this. It's not all doom and gloom. I think that there is a lot of understanding out there these days, and with good understanding will come appropriate accommodations and treatment.
I love to tell a story of Temple Grandin, who's, you know, the superstar of autism. You familiar with her, Phil?
Yes.
Okay. So I was at a conference with her, and she was a keynote speaker, and the theme was on social skills for children on the autism spectrum. And she holds up on her PowerPoint a picture of NASA. And she says, you think this is a federal agency where brilliant people come in and create things in outer space to study? She said, it's not. She said, it's a sheltered workshop for people on the autism spectrum.
That's very funny.
So, you know, it's like we find where we belong
exactly
in life. And, boy, once you do that, you know,
It's also important to understand that with dyslexia and learning disabilities, that these also, they're not just school-based issues. These do carry over into the social interactions. If I'm misinterpreting your cues, or if I'm not following what you're saying, then we're going to have a breakdown of communication, right, which then leads to potential social
difficulties. If we don't understand each
other. You don't even have to be autistic to have those kinds of social.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Ed on the line. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? I just wanted to make a comment how I'm a 48-year-old survivor of dyslexia, and you've been able to use technology in my lifetime, going all the way back from the Webster, you know, spell checker, and then into Word and the Internet, and it's just been a great help for me being able to have this technology come to be. I can't imagine what people went through before technology was there to help them out with their dyslexia. Oh, let me take my comments off here. Thanks.
That's such a good point, Ed. Thank you, Rich.
Yeah, I joke with people, especially from high school and beyond into college and adults, that it's a wonderful time to have a learning disability. There's some amazing technology that is out there.
Like what?
One that I really like is, for example, the Kurzweil 3000. It's expensive, but you can take any reading material and it scan it into the computer or upload it as a file. It reads it back to you in a synthesized voice, but it's highlighting in yellow. It's like putting on, when you're having a reading difficulty, it's like putting on glasses that allow you to read. Now, it's not teaching you to read, but it's at least giving you that compensatory technology. There's also a laser pen that translates. You know, you come upon a difficult word, insidious, porcupine, whatever, and the pen will, you scan it right over the word, and it speaks it out to you as well as can give you the dictionary definition.
You know, that's how I discovered I had a learning disability. No, it was many years ago. Marty Moss Cohen was my producer. And I was reading over a paragraph before the show, and typical of me, I read the paragraph three times, and I had no idea what was in the paragraph. And finally, I turned to Marty, and I said, I give up. Will you read this paragraph to me? And I got it.
Right.
I said, oh.
Sure.
Oh.
Well, the more you can multi-sense, you know, bring it to into the person with different channels, the better it'll be. But that's where someone taking responsibility for their own learning is helpful. That's right. Where maturity kicks in.
Speaking of maturity, we've got Valerie on the line. Hi, Valerie.
Hi. I called because I am married to a man, 49-year-old man, who suffers terribly from dyslexia and suffered terribly in school. He's very intelligent. He's very educated, in fact, really well-educated, became a landscape architect. But the scar he has been left with is that he's literally terrified of interviewing for jobs. And it has kind of forced him to be in a situation where he's not working at his potential or even close to it. He said to me that so many times when he's on an interview, he has the sense that it reminds him of speaking up in class and being made fun of. And I just wondered if you had ever heard of that or have any ideas about how I could help him.
Sure. Let's hear from both our guests. First, Rich, and then we'll go to Phil.
Yeah, this years of difficulty that he's struggled with, maybe you could tell him, if, you know, if I had to demonstrate my landscape architecture skills, he would be, you know, laughing at my abilities in a sense. I mean, I think if you can try to help normalize it again for him and have him gain some perspective on what his strengths are and what some of those weaker areas are, maybe he can practice interviewing and try to, you know, grapple with that part of him that doesn't work as well. But I do think, I go back to that word normalizing, that he's in good company. You know, depending upon what part of us, in a sense, is being exposed in terms of our own abilities, we're going to look smart or not so smart.
Yeah, I'm also a big fan of leading with the chin. And, you know, my style is to go in there and say, look, you know, here's what I'm good at, here's what I'm not.
Right.
I've got a learning disability called dyslexia, which makes me bad at interviewing, but it makes me great at landscape architecture. Phil, what you want to weigh in on this?
I'm sorry?
Do you want to weigh in on this? Do you have
Yes, I would love to. It's interesting to me because I know a lot of architects are dyslexic, or I'm hearing from a lot of people, and people who go to into anything that is visual, often, you know, almost as a retreat on one hand from their dyslexia and the verbal, often emphasize the visual to the extent where anything verbal, it becomes difficult or they become self-conscious about it. And I think that one remedy might be simply, because I work with students who, some of them are dyslexic, most of them aren't, but some of them are, would be just to accentuate the verbal. Like one big asset is books on tape, listening to books, hearing them, hearing narratives, being surrounded by the verbal can just help strengthen and emphasize and balance the visual.
So we're back to themes of compensatory mechanisms.
Seems to be my one field of expertise.
I was just thinking as you were talking that, you know, I have difficult reading is not easy for me. It's laborious, and reading journals. Yeah, and reading journals is like a nightmare because, I mean, they're experts at poor writing. I mean, it's just atrocious. And I just realized that this radio show is about my continuing education because, you know, I get these experts on and they talk to me. I don't have to read it. So this is all about me,
Brilliant. Yeah.
Listen, I want to get to something, Phil, that you did that was quite moving for me. You, part of your sense of rejection came from your Judaism and how you couldn't read Hebrew, and you felt a sense of rejection from your religion. Well, one of your poems in your collection, called "The God of Loneliness: Selected and New Poems," is called Yom Kippur. Could you tell us about it and read it for us?
Yes. When I was in fifth grade, the teacher once stuck a book in my hands and said, "The principal's coming. Please pretend that you're reading it." And there was a tremendous sense of shame involved in that, and that carried over. And since I was thrown out of Hebrew school in a week, they figured if I couldn't learn English, that I certainly couldn't learn Hebrew. I, to this day, don't know Hebrew, and when I go to the temple on the high holidays, I hold a prayer book, and I find myself pretending to read it, and it makes it difficult, and it certainly affects my relationship with, and I love the music on Yom Kippur, and what's interesting about this poem to me in particular is that last year I read to, my rabbi has me read to the congregation, and when I got home, an Israeli friend wrote me saying that in his conservative temple in Jerusalem, the rabbi read this poem, and he also, since he knew that my friend knew me, he wanted to know if the poem was written originally in Hebrew because it sounded as if it were, which is probably one of the great compliments.
It really was. So give our audience a treat. Read it for
okay.
us.
Okay. So. Yom Kippur. You are asked to stand and bow your head. Consider the harm you've caused, the respect you have withheld. anger misspent, the fear spread, the earnestness displayed in the service of prestige and sensibility, all the callous, cruel, stubborn, joyless sins in your alphabet of woe, so that you might be forgiven. You are asked to believe in the spark of your divinity, in the purity of the words of your mouth and the memories of your heart. You are asked for this one day and one night to starve your body so your soul can feast on faith and adoration. You are asked to forgive the past and remember the dead, to gaze across the desert in your heart toward Jerusalem, to separate the sacred from the profane and be as numerous as the sands and the stars of heaven, to believe that no matter what you have done to yourself and others, morning will come and the mountain of night will fade, to believe for these few precious moments in the utter sweetness of your life. You are asked to bow your head and remain standing and say amen.
That is so beautiful and so powerful. Philip Schultz, you're coming to Philadelphia soon?
Yes. On November the 3rd, I'm going to be at the Ames School in Philadelphia. It's a learning disabled school to accept an award, and I'll be reading there, and I'll be that evening.
Well, mazel tov to you, and a happy new year to you, Philip.
Same to you. Thank you. And to you, Rich.
Thank you very much. Thank you, you too.
Philip Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and author of My Dyslexia. Rich, thanks so much for
joining us. Thanks, Dan. Thanks
for
having me on. It's great. Thank you very much.
This was great. Dr. Richard Selznick is a psychologist and a professor. He's the author of The Shutdown Learner, Helping Your Academically Discouraged Child. I highly recommend that book. Well, next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to talk about families coping with mental illness. There's a new documentary out, and a very powerful one that tells one family's story. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer today has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Our intern is Emily Haas. Mike and Scott's our executive producer and directed today's show. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. The host, oh, that's me. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friend.